Our topic today, again, our speaker is MLA Greg Wiedek, and he's speaking on the topic of have Albertans given the Stalemate government a free ride. Just before we invite Greg back, I'd just like to let you know what's up for next week, December the 11th. We have a very interesting topic, conscientious objection to military service and citizenship, a Canadian perspective. Our speaker is Dr. Amy Shaw, who is at the university, associate assistant professor of history, and her specialty is the area of Canadian history and Canada at War and Peace. And she has dealt with the topic in Canada in two world wars and Canadian cultural history. And her current research centers around Canadian women during the First World War. So it promises to be a very interesting topic around conscientious objection. And so a very interesting topic for next week. So at this time, we'll ask Greg to come back. And there's a microphone at the back. And it's working because... Newt and I checked it beforehand, and it was working. Unless the gremlins have gotten to it, it should still work. And please state your name and make your comments and your questions brief and to the point so that we can have lots of discussion. So, Greg.
Bob Giesbrecht, Greg, you know, we always hear your government referred to as the Stalemate government. They won't give you any leeway. They tie it to a personality. I wonder if you could share with us, we don't know much about our premier down here, because what is his leadership style? I mean, particularly in caucus, because that's where the reality is going to show up. Does he direct caucus? Is he a delegator? Does he believe in deliberation? What's his style? So maybe then we could understand his footprint on anything that comes out.
Well, thanks, Bob, and that is a good question. And part of the reason I ran was because I had gotten to know the Premier as the Transportation Minister and working with some of the communities around here. And what I always liked as a minister, he shot straight. He told you what you could and couldn't get done. If you were in there asking for a project that he knew simply wasn't on the radar, he was the kind of guy that would tell you that, and I've always appreciated that. Working in caucus with our Premier has been a very exciting experience. And he is not a person that walks in the room and delivers a speech on what he wants us to do. He is very much a person that comes in, the issues will come forward, and he listens to the MLAs. He respects the fact, and he appreciates when we can come back and say, we were talking to people in our constituency, and that's why it's critical that you phone and come and see us. He appreciates when we walk in, and he adds a lot more weight to what I have to say when I can say, I had people from my constituency come to my office, and this is what they're worried about. Then he typically will listen very carefully to what different members have to say from different parts of the province. And caucus makes most of the decisions on direction. When the health minister wants to make a change in health, he brings it forward, and 72 people get a chance to speak to it and get a chance to vote on it, and that's how it's done, and it's done very democratically. And our premier works very closely with us, and he defends caucus, and I really appreciate the fact that he allows us to have free and open debate on all the issues, and that has really been something I've appreciated coming from my background, Bob. So that's how he tends to lead, by allowing caucus to have all the input that they can from their communities.
My name is James Moore.
Hi, James.
Hi. Thanks, Greg. You will recall, and Bell Bura will corroborate, that in March we all stood at the university and we had unanimity amongst us on one issue. I was that we would look to make it easy for the students to vote, including having polling booths on campus. The chief electoral officer has come out with a series of recommendations, including that they should be able to decide where they vote. Specifically, the students in West Lethbridge would be able to decide that they wanted to vote in Lethbridge. The chief electoral officer has talked about making voting easy for people and possible for people, rather than difficult for people who did want to go out, and not just for 1 hour, but spend several hours looking for where to vote, how to vote, getting sent around. What are you doing, and what will you do to back up that unanimity on the principle that we need to make it possible and easy for people to vote and do what you said you'd do? I would hope to hear that you're well underway on this.
Well, thanks, James, and you're right. The first thing was to get the chief electoral officer to come back as a member of the legislature and make recommendations. We'll be doing a full review. As you know, the boundary review is also coming up. We have to do the boundary review in 2010 and look at alignment of all the constituencies. And as part of that, we're going to look at how voting can be done, because not only university students, but the whole Blood tribe didn't have a voting station on it. And we have to ensure that all of the people in Alberta have a chance to vote. And the issue around students voting where they live, I think that's a great one, James. And my understanding in the last election was that if a student walked up and said, I'm a Lethbridge resident, they could choose to vote here and could. But we need to make it easier and clearer that they can select where they can vote, because having to drive all the way back to Strathmore to vote can be extremely difficult on a young person. So you're right. And I still support that. There'll be a complete review process, and in that we're going to look at some of the issues we even talked about today to see how they might fit going forward in the election process. Because one of the things that's come up is fixed election dates for discussion as well.
Greg, Bob Anderson.
Hi, Bob.
I'd like to raise again the question of our electoral system. You passed over proportional representation as though it was only one thing, and that some constituencies would be without any representation at all. On both those counts, I think that's wrong. Proportional representation has many faces, many approaches, even including the single transferable ballot. There's a whole lot of options there to consider, and many of them don't leave constituencies bereft. They're designed specifically not to do that. So I'm wondering what a study or movement is underway with your government to review the electoral system in order to make it considerably better than first past the post. You must be doing something.
Thanks, Will. I can tell you that we haven't had a lot of discussion around proportional representation as a party. I spoke from my understanding. But by the same token, you always have to be open to look at changes in systems that may make representation better, and we will. The review that we're doing right now, they're looking at a number of things within the system that we have. There's been no discussion yet about a proportional representation move. That hasn't been on the table. A number of other things have been. Part of it will be the boundary review and looking how rural versus urban boundaries, because significant growth has happened in Calgary and Edmonton, and we're hoping that doesn't come too much at the expense of rural areas where they desperately need to have representation on the floor as well. So that's going to be a big discussion over the next 18 months, Bob. There's been no discussion at all on it. It hasn't come forward. Not to say that any private member can't bring that as an issue for debate on the floor of the House at any time, even from the opposition parties. There is an opportunity to do that. It hasn't come forward from any quarter at this point.
Trevor Page. Thank you very much for your informative presentation. Notwithstanding the moderator's comments about the speaker getting a free lunch, my question deals with you in your capacity as chair of the Cabinet Policy Committee on the economy. And I'd like to know what it is the government is doing to protect small businesses and infrastructure projects in Lethbridge, specifically Lethbridge West, but you can go to the whole of Lethbridge, in the current economic crisis? And is the government actually planning, are you planning as chair of the economic committee, a stimulus package for Alberta?
Thanks, Trevor, and I can answer the stimulus package very easily. No, we haven't specifically talked about a stimulus package as such. We've had a very aggressive infrastructure program in Alberta for the past number of years in transportation. Schools, 17 schools are under construction right now. I believe 14 more have just gone to tender, and we're moving towards the next group. So we are spending more on infrastructure than any other jurisdiction in Canada. And even though the economy has slowed a bit, we're still moving forward with all of the infrastructure programs we had. We believe that to stimulate the economy beyond what we have going right now would not be necessary. But you have to keep watching situations, of course, but all of the programs we have are funded. We have the money in the bank for the next 3 years of infrastructure projects, and we're planning to move forward and build the schools where they're needed, the hospitals. The new radiation center in Lethbridge is going ahead. The two high schools on the west side are going to be completed, and a couple of other school projects are underway as well. So we're going to continue with all of the infrastructure projects we have underway, Trevor, and we believe that will continue to help the economy.
But there are small businesses going broke. There are people losing their jobs right now as we speak. Others are getting second jobs because the whole world knows this crisis is going to last for a couple of years at least.
No, and
so what's being done about that?
There's a couple of things you can do, and one we've been working on is trying to cut some of the red tape and some of the things within government that slow down approval processes within some of the small business sectors. A good example was to process through land titles was taking up to 45 days a year ago. We've worked very diligently because that impacts the construction industry, it impacts the legal industry, the whole processes of real estate. We've got that down to now where most of the turnarounds is about 48 hours. And the other thing we've just added in is a new tracking system where every time in land titles something comes forward, a change to a land title, it's given a number. And you can go online and at any moment check and see on a given title what's in the queue, where it sits, so that if you're going to buy a house, you know exactly what easements or things are there coming against it, which simply wasn't able to be done before. So we're trying to smooth out some of those things to make doing business as easy as possible and as quick as possible to get away from some of the delays that were there.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Greg.
Hi, Bal. How are you?
My name is Bal Bura, and I carefully listened to you what you had to say about that. I don't see a lack of commitment on the part of the people, and when talking about coming to vote, and you think that there is no blank check as far as the 72 members in the legislature in the Lethbridge and the auto in Edmonton. You know, there's numerous issues which need to be discussed, but particularly I want to bring your attention to the Freedom of Information Bill, which was rammed through by your energy minister without the consultation of any members of the House. The second thing is the dissolving the health boards and appointing a super board without the consultation of any other members, which is only nine or 11 other members. Now, how do you explain that the legislature is working for the people of Alberta?
Thanks, Bal. Good. Two excellent questions. On the energy side, we were actually working with the Commissioner for Privacy to try to ensure that the legislation that is put in place allows the amount of information as required, but protects company information that shouldn't be getting out. And it's one of those areas. Another one where we're having some discussions is around the health information. And we've had discussions. The privacy commissioner is concerned that information in healthcare, as we move towards a more computerized information system, may allow it to get out. And there's been discussion about how do we release healthcare information when research is being done, say at the University of Alberta, what information can we release, what shouldn't we release? And so we're working with the Privacy Commissioner because there are genuine needs to release some of this information. But I've had a lot of people say, we do not want our health information out there in cyberspace somewhere floating around. And that is a big concern, and probably the one area that I have had, Val, the most concern is in the health area, even more than the energy. Is that health information, most people believe, is very, very important to them. And so that's going to be a very important and delicate line that we're going to have to walk to figure out how can we get information available when people are doing cancer research without in any way allowing information about individual people out there that shouldn't be getting out. And that's where we've had a significant challenge and are continuing to work with the Privacy Commissioner right now. So that's on the privacy side. On the health boards, we absolutely believe that having one board operating health here is critical. We had 9 different information systems operating around the province within the different health regions. They couldn't necessarily communicate with each other. We couldn't transfer and move information easily. We had doctors and nurses that couldn't easily move across boundaries to deliver services in other places. So we moved to provide one point of purchase for things like pharmacy and one point of delivery so that we can try to get the doctors where we need them and when we need them without some invisible line creating a barrier. We believe that to get the best service possible, we need to get the healthcare into the places where people are and where they need it. And also to focus some very extreme specialties in places like the new Mazankowski Heart Institute in Edmonton, and to try to attract some of the world's top people to these centers of excellence where we can do cancer or heart research and also deal with Albertans' problems. So that was the goal behind one delivery. And if you look at health systems across the world, even as one unit, 3.5 million people, we are small by comparison to a lot of other health areas where you'll get California or places like that where they have 10 times our population. We have a very small group, and when you split that into 9, some of the purchasing opportunities in that were just very limited. To be able to attract and move people through the system was limited, and we believe that this will allow us the chance to do that, Val. And I'm really hoping and praying that it will work well for that.
There's a question up there.
Art Sanford. Greg, one of the jobs, of course, of government is to be concerned about social programs. And I can remember Ralph Klein one day saying that for seniors he had 32 social programs available. And they do a very good job on it. But, you know, there is one real serious social program we have in Alberta that the government is actually a part of and promotes it, and that's gambling. And if you look at a lot of the gambling that's going on, it's a lot of gray heads out there doing the gambling that can't afford it. I mean, not only, you know, horse racing, for example, gets $60 million to promote their sport so they can then put it back into gambling. Somewhere along the line, the government, first of all, needs to get out of being a promoter of gambling. I think the last figure I seen was the government made nearly $2 billion, and the people involved in the system made about an equal $2 billion. It's a tremendous cost to people that cannot afford it. What are you going to do about this? I mean, are you going to continue to see our government promote gambling, or are they going to start backing off and saying, hey, this is an unacceptable social problem?
You know, Art, that's a good question. You know, we've actually, I hate to say this, but as a society, we've become addicted to the money that flows from gambling. And that $2 billion, a major portion of it flows through grants back into the communities. A good example, we just funded a bunch of renovations and roof repairs at the Legion here in Lethbridge. Absolutely needed in that facility, serves a lot of people. That was gambling revenue that did that. So many of our nonprofits and organizations are now so dependent on either working bingos or working casinos, and then also getting the added benefit from money coming through the programs. And it's I would much prefer seeing reduced dependence on gambling, but boy, I'll tell you, there are many organizations in the city here that both of our seniors organizations, LSCO and Nordbridge, have seen a reduction by 50% in their gambling, their bingo income. And it's put them on the brink of being in significant deficits and maybe not even being able to operate. So it's a major issue, but they're relying on it right now just to keep their doors open and provide services to their members. So it's going to be a very delicate one, Art, and I know where you're coming from, because dependence on it is critical.
Thanks, Greg. Enjoyed your talk and talking about the citizens approaching you, and also the citizens' right to be involved and right to vote. And I think I approached you on a specific item, but there's another one I'd like to talk to you about. I want to thank you very much for your speed in answering my question, because the minister hasn't even answered yet. And that was on a citizen's right to vote, and that was on the four-year term of office that was put through by the Mayor Lethbridge without consulting with the people. And then going through an election act review committee, basically putting in the recommendations that it was supposed to have been brought up in 2007, and with further consultation. And my question to you was basically that they were putting in another resolution, and you got me a message back, but I didn't get a definite message on was it going to come back to the citizens to a vote whether they wanted a four-year term of office. But there's also another item that's coming to you, and that's on the municipalities going to the government through their lobby group, the UMA, and asking for the power to of taxation to be able to tax anything that they want. And with the amounts of money that they're getting from you right now, I don't think they need a power of taxation. I just wanted to know whether there's going to be a final thing on the four-year term of office and the power of taxation.
Thanks, Ken. And that has come up a number of times. In fact, when I was on council, the four-year term idea came up even then. It's never managed to get enough support from AUMA to even come forward as a recommendation, but I understand that there may be, and AUMA will always be able to bring the issue forward for discussion. And I know what your point is, whether they bring it forward or not, before a decision's made, can the citizens have a say in it? And I think that's probably very important to do. I don't see a significant benefit in going to a four-year term. Right now, there's a three-year term. There's accountability every 3 years. Even if you put the same people back in, you have the opportunity to question them about what they've done, to challenge them on where they've been, and then to make a decision. And three-year terms seem to be working well for now, but I can only speak on behalf of myself, Ken, and if it does come forward, I can tell you that I'll request that it be a ballot issue, that people have a chance to vote on in the municipal election. So.
Okay.
Yep, and thank you for the question, and the minister, I'll ask him again, but we've talked in caucus, and there's a lot of people that share the same view that I do, but if AUMA comes forward with a strong presentation, then we'll have to get back.
But the power of taxation, has that come up?
It always comes up. Municipalities, as you know, even changes to the off-site levies was a change in how they could tax. We made a move to allow them to tax transportation, and instantly levies in Lethbridge went from $32,000 per hectare to $145,000 over a four-year period. So quadrupling in the money they take in. That goes right on the bottom line of every new house built that your kids, your grandkids want to buy. That's added right to the price of the house. So, yes, there's always a push to increase taxation, and there's always the balancing point. I don't see any real desire to increase the ability to tax. And what's been brought up, and you guys may want to have a discussion about this one day, there's been some discussion at the provincial level that maybe there should be an auditor general, or the auditor general for the province should have the ability to go in and look at how municipal money or provincial money that flows into municipalities is expended, and ensure that it's meeting the needs of Albertans the way it's intended to. And that may be something for discussion.
Well, one time we could do... We could
have another question.
Okay.
Thanks, Ken. You bet.
Hi, Greg. I'm Paul Farrell. My question relates to the budget process and rail prices. We know they started at $147. They're down around $50. I think they assumed $70 last year. I was just wondering what assumptions the government's going to make and how they're going to do that budget process.
Thank you very much. That's probably the question we've been discussing. We last March set $78 as the target. Average target. This year we will exceed that only because it went to $140 for a number of months. But And in the summer, we asked all of our departments to go away and come back with budget increases in the 4% range, and then show us outside of that what other programs and projects and what they would cost. So they went away and did that. This fall, we've had to revisit all of that as oil prices have fallen. And I'll tell you, even trying to peg next year's price is, I have no idea. And when you ask, if you ask three guys at the same bank, they'll give you three different numbers for that. The experts are all over the map from $120 to $40. But most people believe that there's probably a range of $70 to $80 that's reasonable, that you can extract the oil for, and that's fair in the marketplace. Whether or not they're a lot smarter than I am to come to those numbers, but that seems to be the number that most people are predicting. We are going to have to budget much more prudently this time, and I would expect we would be better to budget lower, get our costs in line, and if oil prices go up, then look at some of those extra programs. But one of the challenges we're facing is the cost of the three big things that Albertans really want: healthcare, education, and advanced ed are going up. And if you look at advanced ed, for example, as the market has slowed, enrollments are climbing in all of our colleges and universities. Well, that enrollment increase is a direct cost to the province, but it's a great time to educate our kids. So I would hate to think that we would turn anyone away for a lack of funding. So we need to figure out how to prioritize and make sure that things like that, getting our kids educated, can be done. And we're fighting the pine beetle out there, and that's another one where it can cost you $80 or $100 million, and it don't look like much, and it doesn't spread very far, but I think everybody in this room would hope that we would continue with those kinds of things. So we're up against the wall on a number of areas, but we're really focused on advanced ed, education, and health as the three areas that we have to continue to work on. Some of the other ministries, agriculture actually took a 14% reduction this year in their budget, and I give the Minister George a lot of credit, but he went through and offered some packages to some senior people, trimmed some things down, and they're working to try to reduce some of the costs in that department. But you don't want to get it too thin either, because agriculture is a very important part of our economy in Alberta.
Hello, Greg. My name is Brigitte Byers. I'm very concerned about our healthcare system. In a country that has fought that hard to get a really overall healthcare system, I am very concerned what is that so many private clinics are being allowed to establish, taking away from the common good of the healthcare system to the population. Alberta has so much, is spending such a small amount of the budget on healthcare compared to other things. And can you tell me what the government is planning, whether there is a hope that we will keep it healthcare system for all the people?
Sure. Thanks for that question. As a part of our budget this last year was $37 billion for everything in the province, and that includes education and ACE and everything. Healthcare, just the health department, was $13.7 billion of that. And if you take the healthcare portions out of the seniors' budget and the youth budgets, it's probably $15 billion. So it's 40% of our budget, and the way it's projected, within the next 3 to 5 years, it could be 50%. 50 cents out of every dollar we spend could be in healthcare. So we do need to start to look at ways that we can manage those costs into the future as we age, or we're not going to be able to afford the healthcare. The private clinic issue, as a government, Premier Stelmach has come out and said, we as a government support the Canada Health Act, and we will support all of the principles of the Canada Health Act and ensure that a publicly funded public health care system will be available in Alberta. Having said that, a lot of the delivery, most doctors operate in a clinic that's privately owned and privately run, and the money flows through that private clinic. There are services, especially unlisted services like plastic surgery, some different things are delivered through private clinics, but typically most services in Alberta are delivered through publicly funded facilities. But we have heard about a couple of facilities in Calgary offering some types of specialized service, and I'm not an expert on those, that new clinic, the Sheldon Schumer, and the other clinic that opened. I can get you some more information, but yeah, thank you.
Hi, Greg. I'm Bill Brown. I have a suggestion for your budgeting. Why don't you tax people for the cost of running this province, then collect the money from the oil revenue, do what Alaska does, give it back to us? It would be much more easier to budget, and everybody would know where they stood.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, that's a discussion we're going to have. Bill, that's... We've had a bunch of presentations in the last 6 months on a savings plan for the province. How much we should save, where the revenue should go, where the oil revenue should go, how we should we give it back to people? Ralph Bucks came out once, so that I remember, $400 per person. They came out, everybody appreciated them. But Alaska simply gives money back to their people on an annual basis. So... our Iris Evans, our finance minister, right now is in the process of putting together a financial management plan that would show us how much should we save, where should it come from, what's the goal of the Heritage Trust Fund, so that we can balance all of that, so that we can either give money back to Albertans or use it for other services.
It would be nice to give some thought to what the pocketbook of the ordinary citizens got. My question, however, really based on something else. I don't know if you've been following what happens up in the Castle Crown area there, but it just seems to me that every time, and I think it's the EUB or whatever it is now, when it holds a hearing, it becomes so restrictive that 90% of the people who feel they're interested don't have any say in it. My question to you is, has anybody reviewed whether it's the legislation that's causing this or whether it's the board attitude that's causing this? I think we need to have at least 50% more of the people heard at these hearings, because if you're interested in what the people think, why do you have committees there that just won't hear them?
Well, I don't think it's a good question. I don't think it's a legislation problem, because through the legislation, they say anyone that's impacted by these developments has to have a right to speak to it. And that being impacted doesn't mean it has to be going right across your land, but you just have to show that the board that it has some impact on you. Also, other organizations, environmental organizations, can apply for status before these hearings because they represent a larger viewpoint as well, and often get recognized to represent groups like Toxics Watch or wildlife organizations will get acceptance to as a group. The minute you get acceptance, you get funding. So it drives the cost of these hearings, because as soon as people get accepted as having a legitimate interest, they also get funded from the proponents to present their case. So it's a question of trying to balance, but number one is making sure the landowners and the adjacent landowners have an opportunity to speak, because they're most important in the processes.
No. They're not most important. We're talking about an environment that everyone has to live in. So everybody is important. And that's one of the problems with your board members, that they are selecting who's important and who isn't. And I'm asking you now, will you move to change that so that we can get reasonable representation on people presenting to these boards?
You know, if that's an issue, Bill, I appreciate you bringing it up, and a couple of people applauded as well. I'm happy to ask that exact question of the board as to what, because I'm not involved as much in that process as to why you can't go up and talk about the Crown Wilderness and she can, or who makes that decision, and who gets standing has typically been more people directly affected as opposed to just individuals from all over that have an interest. But there may be cases where, as you said, you know, the Crown of the Continent watersheds and that impact the whole area may have a larger interest rate than just the people that live in that area. So, good point.
Last question.
I have.
Thank you. Edward Dennis from Picture Butte. Thank you for mentioning schools being under construction. How many of these schools are built with public-private partnership, publicly funded?
Schools, the very first, up until this year, all of the schools were just built as standalone provincial structures. This year, they've gone to a program where they've designed core school designs for K through 6, 6 through 9, 9 through 12, and what a core school would look like, how big the halls have to be, how big the gymnasiums are. and how, like say a core school that would meet the need of 500 high school kids, then you can add on X number of portables to take it, say, up to a larger number. So that was the first step, was to design these cores. Then they went to a P3 on the first grouping of schools, of 17 schools that were mostly in Calgary and Edmonton. They were put out on a P3. The estimates were done at first that it would cost us around $800 million to build them, if we just built them one off ourselves based on the prices we've been getting. We went to the P3 model, put them to tender, and saved $150 million in the cost. And that was reflected in the fact that the contractor could go out and buy the doors at once for 17 schools, because there's a consistent design, a consistent kind of door, go to the manufacturers, windows, same thing. They could go to sub-trades in different areas and say, we have this much work. So we've been able to save $150 million on the first 17 P3 schools. There's been lots of discussion on whether P3s are the best way to go or not, but in the case of these schools, it's been a significant cost savings. What we have to make sure is that the maintenance going out matches that, Everett. That's the important part.
A supplementary question, if I may, Mr. Chairman. When we build our public institutions with public funding, why then are we giving our natural resources still away to the oil companies, and all we got left is the pollution? I think we have 175 billion barrels of oil in the oil sands, according to the government, and what do we get out of it? Nothing. Because we can't build our own house with our own money. We have to go borrow back from who finances us, the oil companies or natural resource development. And, you know, it seems to be a point that we short the money, and on the other hand, we have lots to give away, and we keep giving it away and giving it away. Just recently, there was a $1.8 billion cut in revenue that we were supposed to get, but we lowered the royalties on the new wells being drilled. You know, I think it's poor management, but your math might be okay, but the management is a bit slipping.
And there's a lot of questions in there, Everett. You and I will get together enough coffee, but I appreciate the comments that you had in there. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay, we want to thank Greg Wiedek very much for his presentation and for being here today. And thank all of you for being here and for your questions and your interest. And we look forward to seeing you next week as we have another interesting topic around conscientious objection. So thank you very much. And there you are, sir.